Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you for joining us today. A little shout out today to those of you who are listening in, I don't know, Madison and Duluth and Bismarck. I probably haven't had a shout out lately to Waterloo or Sioux Falls. So hello, everyone. Hope everybody's doing great. If you're listening to us online at myfaithradio.com, welcome as well. We'd love to know where you're listening. So you can always email me, Carmen at myfaithradio.com. You can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. You can always text us in the studio, 877-933-2484. Is that right? Is that the right phone number? Okay, that's good. Ted's in my ear saying, yes, that's the right phone number. 877-933-2484. It's also 877-933-FAITH, but I don't even know how to call phone numbers anymore that are letters. So there you go. Okay, so that's my personal crisis of the day. Having worked through that, let's take the headline news of the day and let's begin to digest it. Let's begin to prepare ourselves to enter into the conversations of the day with not only the mind of Christ, but the very spirit of Christ. So let's bring all of that to bear on this particular headline. So this is from the Washington Post. Here's the headline. Children are being euthanized in Belgium. So we have been talking for some time about the right to die legislation here in the United States. Creeping euthanasia laws might be another way of thinking about that. And we have been watching stories out of Europe in relationship to sort of the trends in this direction. And so we've been talking now for a number of years about the Netherlands, which was the first country to legalize euthanasia, followed very quickly by Belgium in 2014. So, well, in 2014, they actually amended their legislation in Belgium. So it's been legal for a number of years. But in 2014, they amended their euthanasia legislation, which was already one of the most permissive in the world, and they began authorizing doctors to terminate the life of a child at any age if the child makes a request. So let's just think about that for a moment. Maybe you think it's one thing to let an older person who has lived a rich life and simply wants to choose the time and manner of their own passage. Maybe somehow you think that that's legit. Well, so once you begin to open the door to any form of, let's just say autonomy, that I'm gonna choose the time and manner of my own death. Once you begin to allow for suicide under any circumstances, you ultimately can't prohibit suicide under any circumstances. And so for a year after the law passed in Belgium, no one actually acted on it. However, euthanasia for children is no longer just a theoretical possibility. And so this is what I bring to you today. Now, I actually, somebody asked me in the hallway at an event I'm attending earlier today, hey, what are you going to talk about today? And I said, well, I'm leading off with this news from Belgium that between January of 2016 and December of 2017, Belgian physicians have actually lethally injected three children under the age of 18. Now, one of those was 17, so we've actually already talked about that on the program at an earlier time. But two of the children are under the age of 12, a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old. Well, I got that far in my explanation, and the person who asked me, he began to weep. And I realized that I think that there are times that we approach the headlines and we assume that people are operating with a similar level of information. They've talked about these things in the past. It's not the first time that they've considered that people around the world are taking the lives of the most vulnerable or people who they view as having become a burden in some way to them. This gentleman who asked me this, he said, I have a special needs child. I just am having a really hard time even imagining that any parent would ever do such a thing. And what's going on in Belgium is when we talk about doctors ending the lives of these two particular children, this 9-year-old and this 11-year-old, we have to recognize that everyone involved, all of the adults involved, are placing the burden of decision-making on the child. And so children are really not in any kind of position to make these kinds of decisions. So when we have these conversations, we have to start by asking ourselves, you know, do we actually think we hold we possess somehow the right to life and death? Somehow we are going to be people who have the capacity to make decisions about when and how people should die. Well, which people and how? And what are the limits of that? And so if you're not pro-life from a biblical standard like conception to natural death, then where are you placing those barriers or those guardrails in the conversations about abortion on the one end and euthanasia on the other? These are substantive conversations that we as Christians absolutely have to be prepared to have. And there are ethicists here in the United States and around the world who are of the opinion that, you know, children up to a certain age should be, you know, they shouldn't be considered human yet. And then people after a certain age really shouldn't be considered human anymore after their capacity to be contributing members of society has left. So you and I are going to be faced in the culture with conversations that border on taking literally into our hands that which belongs under God's sovereignty alone. And so here's the process that they're following in Belgium. The Belgium law doesn't want to, you know, have any mistakes. And so doctors have to verify that a children is in what is considered a hopeless medical situation, experiencing what the doctor considers to be unbearable suffering, and that death is imminent. Well, okay. So once we start saying, hey, these are the circumstances under which we are going to allow for the euthanizing of a child, you and I both know that although we get told a lot that slippery slopes are not real and that's just us fanning, you know, the flame of fear, it is real. And all we have to do is look to the Netherlands for evidence of just how real it is. So you will recall that we have talked earlier this year about a 29-year-old woman in the Netherlands who was physically perfectly healthy, but who no longer wanted to live here and no longer wanted to be alive. And she did make several attempts to take her own life, and those attempts were unsuccessful. And so she went through the process of applying to be euthanized, for physicians to participate in her suicide. So by doctor-assisted suicide or physician-assisted suicide, she not only took her own life, she involved other people in the experience, and they shared it on social media. And so we've not only become in many ways a culture of death, we have become a culture that have become voyeurs of death. And so I raise these concerns today so that you will return to your prayer closet and really genuinely consider life and death and genuinely consider God's sovereignty over life and death and genuinely consider the lordship of Jesus Christ in this life. And be a person who advocates for life from conception to natural death. And if you and I are not advocating for it, I can guarantee you the world will continue to move in the direction that it is currently moving, which is to eliminate people who have become problematic and suffering that that they think they can somehow eliminate. Again, we approach these conversations with genuine concern and compassion for the individuals involved. No one wants to experience having a child who's terminally ill, and certainly no one wants to experience the loss of a child. I acknowledge that. I recognize that. And the role and responsibility of Christians who constitute the body of Christ in the world today, the family of faith that is the church, it's our responsibility to come alongside families who are having these kinds of experiences and be a system of life and support, and to advocate for the protection of the vulnerable. We are not autonomous beings. We actually live in a world that is created by, governed by, and fully belongs to God. And so how we act and behave as recipients of the gift, not only of life, but of the responsibility of you know, the stewards of the things of life are important. All right, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Next up, I'll be joined by John Gabriel. He is the editor-in-chief of Ricochet, ricochet.com. You can follow him on Twitter at exjohn, kind of a fun follow on social media. We're going to be talking today about his op-ed in yesterday's USA Today about the chilling effect on free speech and free association in the drive to expose so-called dark or dirty money. Now, let me just tell you that by this definition, all of us have probably contributed what would be considered dark and dirty money. So it's an important conversation for us to have, and we're going to have it next right here on Connecting Faith. Hey friends, I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I am joined today by John Gabriel. John is he's an opinion contributor to all kinds of media outlets. He is also the editor of Ricochet.com. You can follow him on Twitter at exjohn. John, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Great to be here.
So your areas of conversation and influence tend to be very political. And so one of the reasons that I want to talk with you is because I think that sometimes those of us on Christian radio think that, you know, the arena of politics, that just must be the purview of, you know, journalists who are exclusively focused on all the nasty business that's happening out there. But there is a truth that needs to be told, and there are stories that need to be told, and there are connections that need to be made for people of faith in stories like the one we're going to talk about now, because freedom of speech is related to freedom of religion. And so talk with us about this piece that you have posted in the USA Today. The headline, and this is probably their headline, not yours, "Worried about danger of political dark money? Don't bother. Secrets make democracy better." Tell us what this story's about.
Well, we've had several situations, and we saw the Redhead restaurant kicking out Sarah Sanders, and people getting very attacking public figures for their political beliefs. And we've had Brendan Eich, who is in charge. He's one of the founders of Mozilla, which is in charge of the Firefox browser. And he was basically hounded out of his role as CEO because 5 years earlier he had made a donation to opposing same-sex marriage, a group opposing it in California. And this had happened, like I said, 5 years before. The California courts already threw out the voters' decision that they should not allow same-sex marriage, but progressive activists are never in a mood to forgive and forget. And more and more you're seeing this around the country, people being hounded. And there is a proposition in the state of Arizona, where I'm from, where they want to force all donations to be public. So they set a spending limit at $2,500, but that could be much lower depending on the state you're in. Many states are trying efforts like this, and they call this the sinister name of dark money or dirty money to make it very scary that people are doing anonymous donations. And my article simply says this is what makes democracy work. People, it's very understandable that people would not want to donate money if they know, say, they work for a progressive organization and they're supporting a conservative cause, or vice versa. If you listen to the rhetoric of a group like Planned Parenthood or the ACLU about how violent their opposition is, why would they want all of their donors exposed either? So no matter which side you go on, it makes perfect sense that people would want to keep their donations quiet, especially if they're in a sensitive job.
So there's people listening right now who are thinking to themselves, I don't want people to know what I'm giving to, not because I'm not proud of the things that I'm giving to, but because Jesus told me to, you know, not let my right hand see what my left hand was doing, in terms of like that I'm going to get the glory on earth instead of in heaven, and that's not really why I'm giving. And talk with us about your own experience of being, you know, of doing a job in an environment where maybe your personal private opinions and therefore possibly the things that you were supporting financially, who knows, were not necessarily aligned with the pervasive environment or the prevailing opinion of most of the people with whom you worked. Just tell us about what that's like.
Yeah, well, I spent the vast majority of my life in the private sector. After I was in the Navy, I worked for various private sector companies, and they were all apolitical, but in many of them, it was extremely progressive. Everybody around me was progressive. And, you know, I kind of kept my opinions to myself, would speak up, obviously, if it was a matter of conscience, but these were apolitical groups, but there's no way that I would want to, you know, pick a political fight or let everybody know, you know, if I'm up for a promotion, let everybody know what my beliefs are politically, especially since it didn't affect my job. And that's why on Twitter, my Twitter name is not my full name, because back when I created my Twitter account, I just went by John, and my face is partially obscured. It's like, yeah, I'm a real person, but I want to keep my public and private persona separate, just because I would rather not invite any kind of hassle from any groups, because you say something that someone else doesn't like on Twitter and they will try to get you fired. They'll try to destroy your life. And just using Google, they could easily find out which organization I work for. Oh, find out that my bosses and most of management were leaned far to the left and demand for my head, basically. So I think it's very important that the government not collect data on who is giving to whom, because we know that can be abused. We've had situations in Wisconsin where people who supported Governor Walker were actually, their houses were broken into, the local sheriff's department did raids because it was politically unpopular to be anti-union at the time. And they were stuck in court for a year or two before they cleared their names, but it just completely disrupted their lives. They confiscated their laptops and other computers. So again, do we really want government to have this power to find out who we're giving to and why? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay, so specifically, the law that's being proposed sort of is officially known, well, it's actually officially known as the Stop Political Dirty Money Amendment, which is a very provocative title.
Right.
This is a voter-driven effort. So this is not something that, like, you know, has been that emerged through a legislative process. This arose because couple hundred thousand people are demanding it. So this is a referendum. Am I right?
Right, right. Arizona has very open referenda laws, and anybody can try to get anything on the ballot. This barely met the required number of signatures. It is now in court because a lot of people are saying, well, not all these signatures are valid. So it is caught up in court now, but people do expect it to make it to the ballot. And what's concerning, too, is the way that Arizona, a lot of Western states are like this. If something is passed by voters, especially changing the Constitution as this would do, it's the legislature can't go in and fix it. This is many, many pages. I think it's 1,500 words of legalese. Creating new bureaucracies and new governmental controls. And if one word of it is unclear or wrong, the legislature can't change it. People are stuck with it. So that's what makes it very concerning as well. It's kind of the effort to change a constitutional amendment for the U.S. Constitution. You need pretty much everyone's buy-in. And a lot of these states, you don't need that kind of buy-in. And it could really change organizations. And once there's a government commission checking everybody's donations and who they're donating to, who knows how much that'll grow in the years to come.
Okay, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. My conversation partner is John Gabriel of Ricochet.com. We're talking about an effort in Arizona to change that state's constitution through a voter-driven referendum. And part of what this is designed to do is, you know, clean up the dirty money problem in terms of how campaigns are financed. But because it also includes express language related to, like, chain donations, part of what fascinates me, John, is that if I think about giving my money to a donor-advised fund, in order that, through the donor-advised fund, I can then give to a number of and variety of things, and my name does not end up on the other side of that. The name of the fund ends up over there, but not my name associated with it. Talk with us about this exposure of chain donations through this legislation.
Right. This is one of the really chilling things, especially for the many members of churches out there. If you have a church, let's just call it Arizona Community Church, and they decide to donate $10,000 to a pro-family organization, to a pro-life organization, what the government is asking for here is, okay, where did you get that $10,000? So if there was a parishioner who gave $3,000, that needs to be reported. The actual person's name who just really cares about this issue, and they gave just trying to help out the cause to save babies' lives, and now the government wants a record of why they gave and who they gave to, just because the church decided to donate money. So it gets really tricky, especially when you're giving to various organizations. There are many people who will, in a situation you get an inheritance or you get some unexpected windfall where you would like to tithe. You know, I would like to give 10% of this at least, if not more, to some cause. I'm not a big money person, but I came into this money and I want to honor God with it. And if you give to a pro-life organization, your name could end up on a government list somewhere. It's just very concerning.
Okay, friends, so now you see why this whole thing fascinates me. So back in 1995, there was a decision issued by the Supreme Court on political speech. And at that point, and you quote this, I'm actually now quoting you back to yourself, John, here, and you're quoting Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. So I'm going to read the quote to you so that you can comment on it in the context of this conversation. Anonymity is a shield from the tyranny of the majority. Why is that true?
What's interesting, too, is John Paul Stevens was certainly no conservative, but he understood one thing about democracy is we were founded as a republic to avoid this mob rule. You need to make sure that the minority's rights are respected. And if you go back to the 1950s, you would have, let's just say, the broader Christian culture was the majority, so they made sure to protect minority interests in that as well. If you were of a different faith, if you were of no faith, they wanted to protect those rights. Well, now the situation in this kind of post-Christian evolving world that we have here, there's a situation where if you are a committed Christian, you are definitely a minority, and the government needs to come in and protect their rights. If we got rid of any kind of anonymity in who you vote for or what you've given money to, you could have these online mobs just harassing people like we are seeing happen again and again. You see it on Twitter and Facebook, getting out information on these individuals. One thing I mentioned in the story is public supermarkets had given a small amount of money to a Republican running for office in Florida. Some of the Parkland kids got together and scheduled a die-in, sounds like something out of the 1960s, to harass a couple of the public chain stores and cause problems. And this is just terrible to see, because now Publix has stopped giving money to anyone on politics, left or right.
Okay, friends, we got to take a quick break, but we're going to continue our conversation with John Gabriel about these threats to free speech in the culture and the challenges that they pose for Christians. We're also going to talk about doxing, if you're not familiar with that. All right, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined today by John Gabriel. He is, he writes at ricochet.com. He's got all kinds of fancy titles, but ricochet.com is what we want you to know. And we want you to know you can follow him on Twitter at EXJON, which is not that he's like formally known as John. It's a long backstory, and you can engage with him on social media about why his Twitter handle is what it is. But John, thank you for being here with us today on Connecting Faith.
Oh, my pleasure.
So let's continue this conversation about the environment that we're currently in. So let's just imagine that I happened to have been with Sarah Sanders, and we had been going out to dinner, and we were not actually able to eat in peace. In fact, we never even got served. Because people showed up, and because they don't like the person who Sarah Sanders works for, they don't believe she has the right to eat food in a restaurant, and certainly the people with her do not have the right to eat in peace. So they were driven out. And then you made reference to this public supermarket experience that's actually probably still ongoing in terms of how people believe that because they have the freedom to protest, they also have the freedom to disrupt a business and its ability to do business and my ability as a consumer to do business with that business. So just talk with us about, you know, I might feel like I have the right to privacy. Other people would say, well, no, because of the position you're taking, I have the right to out you. Or I feel like I have the right to do business with either Publix or with this restaurant. And they would say, no, because of who you work for, you don't have the right to eat food at all. Talk with us about that.
Well, I think it's important to understand we all have rights, thankfully, but one person's rights end where another's rights begin. And what you see with the public supermarket, who they affected and influenced, it wasn't a CEO in the boardroom of Publix. It was a struggling mom trying to feed her kids who was rushing, trying to rush home to get dinner for her kids.
Well, you've ever been to Publix, I will tell you the one item that is available at Publix grocery stores that is actually not available anywhere else. And that is a Cuban sandwich made with genuine Cuban bread from Tampa. And so if you're a person who lives in Nashville and you've never been to Publix, this is why you have to go, because it's the only place that you can buy this item. So I would say as a person who grew up in Tampa and lives in Nashville, if people are having a die-in at my Publix grocery store, I am being prohibited from attaining one thing that matters to me, which is an authentically Cuban sandwich.
Right. And I think people, anyone protesting, when you start inconveniencing others, they just have to be cognizant of that. And I think the press will glorify pretty much anyone on the left who's protesting, but there's this backlash in the public. I think we saw that with the election of Donald Trump, where the average people who aren't represented in the media are tired of being inconvenienced. And it could be something small like a grocery store or shutting down streets, shutting down a downtown area. Carrying on, lighting cars on fire and the like. There's a difference between free speech and free speech that actually helps one's cause. And I think this is a real problem for the left, is the violence is increasing, the hatred is increasing, and that just turns off a lot of people. You have a lot of Democrats who are voting Republican just because they're tired of the intolerance on their side, and they should really think twice. Is what we're doing effective? Is laying down in aisles in a public supermarket changing anyone's mind to support us? Because I doubt it. It's probably doing just the opposite.
Well, it's a little bit like the response of people to, let's say, Chick-fil-A, right? So Chick-fil-A does huge business when people call for a protest of Chick-fil-A. Like the reverse actually takes place.
Exactly, yeah. And what you see a lot of consumers doing is just voting with their wallets. And anytime Chick-fil-A comes under attack, people who like delicious chicken sandwiches say, ooh, Chick-fil-A, that sounds really good for lunch. I'm going to go get that.
It's the buttered bun, man.
Right,
it's just
exactly.
All about the buttered bun. Okay, so because I have you here and because you know something about this, and I just imagine that I know. So talk with us about doxing, because you alluded to earlier in the conversation that we were having that there are ways that people on social media, online, are doing things that are harmful to other people. Tell us what doxing is, and it's D-O-X-X-I-N-G. For those of you who are listening and thinking to yourselves, that doesn't even sound like a real word.
Right, and it comes from basically document. It's you find the documents of people online. So say I am online and I say something that represents a conservative view. Somebody doesn't like it. They track down my name, my address, my phone number. I've actually on Twitter had people post photos of my house because there's something that they didn't like that I said, and Twitter didn't punish those people. But they'll find out where you live, and there's a way they can mirror your phone number, call into your local police department. This is what's very concerning about it. Call into your local police department and say there's a violent situation going on. So the police actually visit your house sometimes with a SWAT team. That's the scariest version that people who are subject to doxing, that will occur to them. But you also have people who prefer to be anonymous online for all the reasons that we outlined, and people will just say, oh, by the way, your name is Joe Brown and you live at this address and here's your phone number, here's your income level, because you can find so much information online. A lot of people will out other people who would rather keep private, and it's a way of shutting down others' speech just because you don't like it. And you see it mostly coming from the left, but increasingly you're seeing this coming from the right as well, just trying to get people fired for having a different opinion. It's not healthy for any kind of democracy. We should have free and open debate without threats and intimidation like this.
So from a Christian worldview, I will say this. I don't expect John to necessarily comment on this. I'm just talking here to listeners. Let me just remind us that although we often do battle in the conversations of the day, in the world in which we live, we do not do so with the weapons that the world employs. And so even if people are treating you poorly on social media, it gives us as Christians absolutely no excuse to treat them in the same way in return. And so if you need to take a break from social media because it has become a place that is unhealthy for you to be or toxic, or where you are frankly contributing to a misrepresentation of who Christ is and the principles of the kingdom of heaven, then let me encourage you to do that. If you see it as a mission field, if you recognize yourself as a missionary in that environment, if you are there to actually engage in substantive conversation that is both glorifying to God and edifying to people, then stay on social media. So that's just my my little side comment today. Let's talk, John, about Alex Jones. Some of my listeners will recognize his name because on the day that his case was going to be heard in Texas, we talked about the importance of truth in relationship to the Sandy Hook families. Like the Sandy Hook families that, because of Alex Jones and the things that he's been doing, they have had to move several times. They have to live in secure locations. And it's because he continues to out their private information publicly and continues to assert that the Sandy Hook massacre was made up, was a hoax. So Alex Jones is a person who I find utterly reprehensible. Tell us what has happened to him lately, and then let's talk about whether or not he actually, you know, has the right to free speech.
Yes, well, a lot of tech companies, they're getting tired of being hit with a label that they encourage hate speech. So Facebook, YouTube, and some other organizations banned Alex Jones from advertising or even having much of a presence on their web services. There are some people, many on the right, saying, oh, this is the beginning of a slippery slope. They're going to end up banning everybody, while other people on the right and the left are saying, no, this is a uniquely terrible person who has done reprehensible things. Pushes conspiracy theories regularly, and some of the ugliest ones are saying Sandy Hook was a hoax. His listeners have harassed the families continually, and I look at this, you're trying to balance the public square and allowing free speech and also understanding that Facebook, YouTube, these are private companies. And I always defer to them just because I'm not paying for this. If they close down my Twitter account tomorrow, which who knows, they could do, well, so be it. I have enough going on in my life where that'll actually free up some good time and I can read some important books instead of engaging online as much as I do. But you want him to have a say in the public square just because otherwise who else are you going to be banning? He got into trouble with Facebook because he does violate the terms and conditions of service there. And so I don't think getting rid of him online like this is a problem. He still has his website. He still commands a huge following. If anything, I think this measure will give him a lot of free press. It will be very concerning, though, if these organizations start silencing people for, quote-unquote, hate speech because someone is pro-life or they have a traditional view of marriage or a traditional view of gender. That's where the alarm bells will really be ringing if they try to pursue this much further.
All right, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I now have one deeply personal question for John before we let him go today. So one of the things that we talk about from time to time is what it's like for Christians to, you know, carry the name of Christ into the world. And we're seeking to actually be authentic representatives of Jesus Christ. So we want to have the mind of Christ, and we want to be possessed of the Spirit of Christ. We want to be ambassadors of Christ, all these things. You have the additional burden and challenge of carrying the name Gabriel into the world. So I would like for you to tell us what that's like.
It's interesting. I don't live up to the name much or a lot of the time. One thing I like about it, though, is Gabriel was the messenger angel, and that takes a lot of burden off me. I just need to testify and share the message, and don't look up to me. Look up to Christ. He's the one to actually emulate. I'm just the messenger telling you what I know and what he's told me to tell you. So hopefully on my really, really good days, I halfway measure up.
So what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm following a lot of local political action. There's so much news media attention focused on Washington, D.C., and I like focusing on what's going on in the states because that's where change happens. That's where a lot of laws happen, and they just don't get covered by the D.C. press corps who are just their hair is on fire because Trump tweeted something, and that's all they can focus on. So looking around the country, seeing what's going on out among real people in the real country, not just the people, the big wigs in D.C.
Okay. All right. So those of you who have no big wigs but are out there dispersed across the country, this is your opportunity to send a real journalist leads on the kinds of things going on in your communities, in your state, that you know about, that a guy in Arizona wouldn't know about unless people communicated with him. So you can actually, now here's a good use of Twitter. You can communicate with him on Twitter. He's at EXJON.
Yes, please do. I love to hear that. And all these stories are so undercovered, and they affect real people. And I really, any chance to get those stories out is a great opportunity.
You guys can also find him at ricochet.com. John Gabriel, thanks so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you.
Hey, friends, I got to take one more quick break. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back.
For this is what I'm glad to do.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We are going to make the connecting point. One of the reasons I wanted to ask John the question about his name is because it's actually one of the things that I do when I am in an environment when there's lots of new people. And so you kind of want to get to know people. And if you kind of hone in on their name and you ask them something about it, at least for me, it helps me remember their name the next time that I see them. And so especially if a person has a name that is unusual, particularly ethnic, maybe for me, difficult to imagine how it would be pronounced. So I actually ask a lot of people, okay, so I see your name, but I really don't want to attempt to say it until you tell me how. However, you'll run across people who are like Jeff Brown. I'm like, well, that's not, if your name is Jeff Brown, please do not take offense at that. It's just that's, if your name were Charlie Brown, it'd be easier to remember. So, we ask the question of who we are and who we present ourselves to be and how we present ourselves and not just what's the name on a name tag that we're wearing. Although that says a lot about us, right? It communicates a lot about us for people to know our name. But you and I aren't representing ourselves in the world. We're representing Jesus. And so what does it mean not only to be a person who bears the image of God into the world, but a person who is genuinely seeking to allow my life moment by moment by the working of the Holy Spirit within and on me for my image to be conformed more and more to the image of who Christ is? So let me tell you why I'm bringing this particular nugget up today in our conversation. I have been particularly disturbed by an increasing number of headlines related to young people and plastic surgery. There was a headline last week out of Canada related to a plastic surgeon there who is performing double mastectomies on girls, 14 and under, who believe they are boys and therefore don't want the developing part of the body that is removed in a double mastectomy. Here in the United States, plastic surgeons have noticed what they call a developing trend. It now has a name, Snapchat dysmorphia. Snapchat dysmorphia is, according to research from Boston University's School of Medicine, related to people who want to look more like the filtered and edited versions of themselves that appear on Snapchat and Instagram. So there's all these filters that you can use on pictures that you – so people are taking selfies. Let's start with that. They're taking a selfie. They are then modifying that selfie through a series of filters and other ways of editing pictures. I mean, making their wrinkles go away and their teeth whiter and whatever, right? And adding these filters that make them look unlike themselves, but apparently like they now want plastic surgeons to make them look in real life. They want to look like the image of themselves on Snapchat. And we're talking about a 55% increase of surgeons who are reported seeing patients who sought surgery so that they could look more like their filtered selfies, or that they would have to filter their selfies less. The Boston University researchers, the ones who are quoted in the article, noted that it is often unattainable for human beings to look like their filtered selfies, because the apps are blurring the line of reality and fantasy, and people actually cannot become fantastical versions of themselves. Okay, so what should people look like? And what does this say about the selfie culture, where the selfie culture has actually arrived? What does this say about how we see ourselves, how we see others, and the image that we are projecting into the world? And so I want to prepare us to actually have conversations, particularly with young people, but maybe just with each other as adults as well. To desire, I mean, actually desire in our heart of hearts, not to look like some filtered image of some selfie that we post on social media, but to remember who we are as the image bearers of the living God, an image that is marred by sin, no question about it, but that by the power of the Holy Spirit, an image that can be improved over time, that actually can come into greater conformity with the image of Christ. Like that's the filtering process. That's the editing process that my selfie wants. I want in my heart of heart to be more like Christ. I want to more authentically bear the image of Christ into the world. And that is in terms of, does it matter how I look? Well, I certainly want to be what Scripture would describe as a beautiful testimony, like, right? So I certainly want to treat my body as a temple of the Holy Spirit. Am I worried about the crow's feet that are, you know, gifts of wisdom around my eyes and smile lines around my lips? No, I'm not. And I don't filter them out on Instagram. I'm not on Snapchat, but I don't filter them out on Twitter or Facebook Live. I'm not saying that you can't spend, you know, 2 seconds making a picture look a little bit better before you post it on social media. That's actually not the point of the conversation. The point is the image that we're bearing into the world and the selfie culture in which we live, where young people are so obsessed with how they look on social media that it is absolutely affecting their self-image in real life. So one of the things that the researchers found in relationship to this, and you can read these headlines in a number of places. I actually like the article that is posted at thehill.com. This particular article is entitled Plastic Surgeons Say More Patients Coming In with Snapchat Dysmorphia, posted 2 days ago by Avery Annapol. But there's a number of versions of this article out there in terms of where you might consume it in the news. So it grows out of a American Academy of Facial Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery survey in 2017. That's the research behind it. The Washington Post reported widespread availability of photo editing software is changing patients' expectations of what they can and should look like. One doctor told the Washington Post, sometimes I have patients who say, I want every single spot gone. I want it gone by this week, or even I want it gone by tomorrow, because the filtered photograph looks like this. And when I show up, I need to look like my filtered photograph. Okay. First of all, that's not realistic, the doctor says. I literally cannot do that. But we've also come to the place where we have the expectation that some version of ourselves is better than reality. Well, the version of ourselves that's better than reality is the Christ-conformed version of ourselves. It's the redeemed version of ourselves. It's the radically transformed by the inner working of the Holy Spirit, transformed from one degree of glory into another version of ourselves. It's the Galatians 2:20, no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me, version of ourselves. It's the taking off of the old self and all of its proclivities to sin and putting on a new self, and over all these things, putting on a covering of love. That's the selfie we want to be promoting and encouraging. And the image that we want to be talking about, the image that we want to be projecting, is the image of Christ. That's the name that you and I mean, John Gabriel has to carry the name Gabriel into the world. And that's kind of cool. But you and I, as Christians, we're carrying the name of Christ into the world. And you bear his image. Now, you bear his image because you are a human being created in the image of God, but you also bear the image of Christ, especially because as a person who has, in baptism, died and been raised to newness of life in Jesus Christ, you actually then become a Christ-filled, Christ-minded, Christ-kingdom-advancing person. That's your image, filtered hopefully through the scriptures and the power of the Holy Spirit, engaging the world in ways that that glorify God and edify people. So this is a conversation we absolutely have to have with young people who are on Snapchat. Apparently it brings, according to the article, feelings of sadness. And this sadness progresses into something that is dangerous and alarming, and to the place where people want to have body-altering surgery in order to make them look more like the filtered image of themselves on Snapchat. All right, friends, I want to know what you're reading and what you're thinking about. And one of the places that you can communicate with me is via email, carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can communicate with me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. I do have an Instagram account. I don't really use it for selfies, but you can certainly follow me on Instagram. Love to connect with you there. And my ministry website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. That's where I post hopefully what you would find to be thoughtful blogs about such things, like this particular conversation about Snapchat dysmorphia. This week, I really have the opportunity to be having some, I hope what you will find, interesting conversations with live guests here in the studio. Also have the opportunity to meet some very interesting people that I will bring conversations to you over the course of the next several weeks that I'm having this afternoon, you know, after we're off the air. And so I would just appreciate your prayers for my own endurance. I've got four interviews that I'm going to be recording here this afternoon, and I want them to all to be really good. And I want to know the content of not only these people's experiences and the context of their service, but the content of their character. So if you'd send up a little prayer for me while you're doing whatever you're doing today, I would genuinely appreciate that. Hey, you could send up a prayer for the whole Faith Radio team. We could all use it. Hey, friends, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I look forward to meeting you right back here again. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.